Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
How many times have you sat in a meeting trying to solve a problem and the boss asks you to think outside the box?
The problem with this phrase is that in most situations, we don't know what the box is.
Is creativity a science? I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
What's actually in my fridge right now? Do we have yogurt or not?
Therefore, there's a code to cover that scenario.
That's not it. That's not it at all.
This is working for me. I'm gonna stick with it, baby.
Ooh. Oh, there you go.
So funny.
Now you got a good one going.
I am a machine.
Some people go too hard. They say, like, I'm not gonna have any more soda.
You know, you didn't have blood tests to determine whether
this task that is probably really important.
When do I get to survive?
If you could survive, will you truly, at the end of that, you feel alive?
On today's show, creative ants that are master bridge builders, pregnant ladies getting creative with the many rules guarding their health, and a magician who creates the illusion that he can read your mind. But first up, we tend to think of creativity as a personality trait or a gift. Oh, that person is so creative, we say with whispered admiration. In the corporate world, those who do creative work have a special status. They make lots of money, and they like to mark themselves with colorful socks, statement necklaces, or crazy ties. But what if creativity could be learned? Even by the guy in accounting who only speaks in spreadsheets. Todd Bookman visited a class that promises to make you a more creative thinker.
First, let's get a definition out there.
So my definition would be, in order for a certain idea to be creative, it must possess two major components. One, it has to be new, novel, something we haven't seen before.
This, by the way, is Professor Ram Schrift.
But it also has to be useful. Okay, so if it's just something new but doesn't offer any benefit, it's not necessarily a creative idea.
Okay, so two requirements to qualify as creative. It must be new and useful. Each year, students enroll in Schrift's class at UPenn's Wharton School to learn techniques to generate these kinds of ideas. Schrift has short-cropped red hair and wire-rimmed glasses. He's dynamic in the classroom, bouncing around with his white sleeves rolled up, preaching the gospel of creative thought. But if you think his mantra throughout the semester is as simple as think outside the box, well, it's kind of the opposite.
The problem with this phrase is that in most situations, we don't know what the box is. What is the box? So how can we, if we cannot define the box, how can we actually think outside of the box?
At the core of learned creativity is recognizing what the box actually is. What are the boundaries, the components, the structures that make up the problem you are trying to solve? And what tools, what ingredients do you have on hand? Knowing what these constraints are, he argues, makes it easier to produce creative solutions.
Actually, inside the box, there are a lot of opportunities. And most of the creative ideas, if anything, they come from inside the box.
How about an example to help make this concept clear? A famous example from a famous children's book author, Dr. Seuss. In the 1950s, Seuss, real name Theodore Geisel, he and a publishing friend were unimpressed with the quality of books out there aimed at helping first graders learn to read.
And his friend gave him a bet, made him a challenge, basically, to write a book using a certain number of words out of a bank of words that first graders know.
There were 350 unique words that first graders were expected to understand. And Seuss is now supposed to write a book using 225 of them, and nothing more. Those are his constraints.
He used this constraints, right? He could not use any words, but there was a specific bank of words. And he came up with a cat in the hat.
Look! A cat in a hat!
You will note I am neat. Wiped my feet on the mat.
His publisher saw this and said, interesting. So these constraints, let's have another bet, another challenge. And he challenged Dr. Seuss to write another book using only 50 words. And he wrote Green Eggs and Ham.
I would not, could not in a box. I would not, could not with a fox. I will not eat them with a mouse. I will not eat them in a house.
You can argue, sure, Dr. Seuss is an extremely creative individual, and I agree, but there's something about imposing these constraints that maybe helped them be more creative. And this is kind of the approach we're teaching.
There's a waiting list to get into Schrift's class at Wharton, this despite the fact that it's not all that easy. Topics covered during the semester have names like the attribute dependency template and task unification and closure principle. Students do both group projects and take exams to reinforce these different methods. Nicole Granite, a senior majoring in management, says she's gotten a lot out of it.
I think that I'm definitely more creative than I was before because I can just think about it in a different way. I don't feel like I need to just sort of, you know, close my eyes, listen to some like relaxing music. Maybe something will come to me. I feel like I'm much more in control of being able to produce these ideas that can really make a big change. Sort of be creative on demand when you need to be.
Granite is starting a job in consulting after she graduates. She's going to help companies be more productive and efficient. And creativity on demand will definitely be an asset. Gerard Puccio hears from employers all the time about how much they value that type of skill set. Puccio directs Buffalo State's International Center for Studies in Creativity. His school was the first to offer classes on the topic back in the late 1960s. He says the discipline has evolved over the years as the challenges we face have become more complex.
Creativity is innate. It's a human characteristic. It's the reason why we've survived through the millennia. It's because we have our competitive advantage is creative thinking. We're not the fastest. We can't fly. We don't naturally camouflage ourselves. We can only exist in certain climates. So the human species has evolved to be creative, and in fact, that's what has helped us to sustain ourselves over time. So it's natural. It's innate inside all of us.
Some of us, of course, are still going to be more creative than others. David Ludwig wrote this piece of music. He's a classical composer and professor at Philadelphia's Curtis Institute, one of the nation's top schools. And he's got his own definition for creativity.
I think creativity is an act of finding something that's already there, of discovering, of taking the cover off of something, of brushing away the grime and the dirt until the image comes up from underneath.
This guy is a celebrated artist. He gets inspiration for melodies, you know, just walking around the grocery store. But Ludwig is totally on board with the idea that creativity can be thought of as a skill to hone, that understanding constraints and attributes is crucial to creating something new and useful.
Think about it like if I gave you an assignment and said, draw a house on a piece of paper. The first thing you would do, the first thing anyone's ever done when I've asked them to do that, is they start with the box and the roof, the frame. Always the frame. No one starts with the window and the TV in the living room in the background. No one starts with the little chimney with the smoke coming out of it. That is unhindered creative act, an unconscious creative act. And we naturally put limitations on ourselves. Part of what's very painful about creating is that we have to make decisions and choose A over B. How's that for the longest answer ever to anything?
The short version here is that creativity doesn't work as well when you take a passive approach. You can't just hope for a great idea to pop up. Chase down lots of possibilities, use some strategy, then make some hard decisions. In other words, get inside that box. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Buchman.
All right, Todd Buchman, our box for The Pulse today is the topic of creativity, and we are in it. Now, if you think of genres as boxes for making art, still life provides a pretty rigid structure. Still life pictures have a history of being art in the service of science, and that has led to some creative tensions. Peter Crimmins reports.
Still life paintings are studies of things. Flowers on tables, fruit in bowls, dead animals after the hunt. It's a lowly genre, usually without much drama or prestige to it, but it's one that examines objects very closely. The Art of the American Still Life is the name of an exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art right now, and it takes liberties with that definition because it includes paintings of watches, of locomotives, boxes of Brillo pads. It was curated by Mark Mitchell, who believes still life is really an examination of material culture.
Our goal is to recognize the incredible variety of still life in the American tradition. It is not one thing, and it's certainly not just flowers on a table.
Americans, especially in the early years of the new nation, had something to prove. After winning independence from England, newly minted Americans wanted to establish their own unique identity, their own politics, their own culture. And to do that, they relied on science. America had a different world of plants and animals, which Europeans had no experience of. So American artists roamed the landscape to discover this new flora and fauna. John James Audubon created a massive illustrated book of every species of bird in the United States.
When you think about Audubon's Birds of America, which has 435 plates, it is a majestic undertaking. It is like very little else in all of human history in its scale. And what he's trying to do is to record American nature.
Audubon was an ornithologist, but his artistic ambition had the upper hand. He wanted to sell books. So his pictures needed to be so beautiful that you would want to buy them and hang them over your couch. Most scientific illustrations of birds look like mugshots. There's a clear image of the front, another in profile, some detail showing feather patterns, all against a plain white background. Audubon took great effort to make his birds look good in their natural habitats, often posing dead birds with wires to get them into lively positions. It was aesthetically pleasing, but scientifically dubious. In 1826, he applied to the Academy of Natural Science in Philadelphia for membership as a scientist, and he was rejected. Archivist Robert Peck says the board at the time believed he did not have scientific rigor.
So whenever Audubon was criticized by the scientific community for not knowing the science, he said, "Ah, yes, but I know the birds in life. You guys might know what they look like from a dead specimen, but I've actually seen them feeding their young, catching their prey, flying from branch to branch."
Eventually, Audubon was accepted into the Academy, and it now has an original copy of his Birds of America prominently displayed in the library. In fact, the Academy's back rooms are filled with art. Among millions of preserved and cataloged specimens are thousands of drawings and paintings gathered over the last 200 years. Peck shows off paintings by Robert Verity Clem. He illustrated Shorebirds of North America, the definitive ornithological book published in 1967. He says Clem's watercolors are often compared to the fine art paintings of Andrew Wyeth.
A very similar palette to Andrew Wyeth. And they both have a shared aesthetic of the East Coast. So they saw light and landscapes in very similar ways. It's just where Wyeth would have had Christina on the grass in front, Clem has chosen a bird instead.
Shorebirds of North America was Clem's first and only publication. He was frustrated by the result. He was a stickler for accuracy and hated how the printing process could not recreate his colors correctly.
They weren't true to his original watercolors. And the watercolors are so subtle that if you do put them side by side, you can see there's a difference.
In the 20th century, art and science have moved in divergent directions, one tending toward expression and emotion, the other to intellectual comprehension. The irony of Clem's career is that after the publication of Shorebirds of North America, he never worked in a scientific capacity again. Because in his eyes, scientific illustration was not true to life. For The Pulse, I'm Peter Crimmins.
I'm Mike and Scott. You're listening to The Pulse, and we're talking about creativity on today's show. The science of creativity encourages us to build a structure or a box and to think inside of it. But when you're not aware of the framework that guides your thinking or decisions, that can be a problem. women are underrepresented in the fields of science, technology, engineering, and math, and there is a sense that some of this is related to hiring practices at universities. A group of researchers set out to study this. They met with academics and showed them research on gender bias in academia related to hiring or publishing. Pulse contributor Bethany Brookshire, a writer for Science News, tells us what happened next.
What they found was that while women took those abstracts and kind of accepted them at face value, men tended to pick them apart and be like, oh, well, you know, it's a small sample. I need to see more data, you know, just the little picky things. And they were really surprised by this. They really thought the data would speak for itself. And so they actually decided to do a study. You know, does the data speak for itself? Is this just anecdotal or is it real? Is there bias in the way people look at studies about bias?
And what did they find?
They did a couple of experiments, both in non-scientists, in all academics across fields, and in science, technology, engineering, and math-related academics. And what they found was, overall, in general, people don't hate on these studies. In general, people say, okay, yeah, it's probably a pretty good study. But women tend to rank them as more reliable than men. They tend to rank them as being more powerful, more important, just generally being better studies than men do. And that's specific to science fields. So, you know, other fields like English or creative writing or business, you know, they look at those and they go, okay, yeah, there's no gender difference in the way they view the studies. But in science fields, male STEM academics viewed studies about gender bias with bias. They liked them less.
Or could we say that perhaps the women viewed them with bias? That maybe the women thought, well, yeah. So could we turn that around?
Yeah, I mean, certainly. And the authors talked about that. They said, you know, there could be confirmation bias at work here. This is something that women experience in their daily lives all the time. And so they're going to look at these studies and be like, well, of course, of course that's true. On the other hand, they also found that academics who were not in science fields did not have a gender bias when viewing studies about gender bias.
So what do we do with this finding, or what does it mean?
Well, so what I really liked about this study was they've already done a follow-up. The authors actually designed an intervention. And they assigned some hiring committees and they educated them. They say, okay, this bias is unintentional. It doesn't mean you're a bad person. And so they educated them on how you spot the bias and here's how you get rid of it. And they actually showed, they published another paper in Bioscience and actually showed that if a hiring committee got an intervention on how to recognize bias, they were 6.3 times more likely to offer an academic position to a woman, and the women were more likely to accept.
But doesn't this speak to the field of science in general? You know, when I'm reading the World Health Organization study on processed meats and how bad they are for you, and I don't really want to hear that, then I'm going to tear that research apart. So don't we always do this?
Yes. Yes, we do. And, you know, in science, scientists are trained to evaluate things without bias and to look at evidence they don't want to hear and say, okay, maybe that's right. But the reality is, you know, scientists are people just like anybody else. And I looked at, you know, those studies on processed meat, and I love bacon. And, you know, that was hard for me to take too. I think in the end, it just kind of speaks to the fact that scientists are people and that we need to take that into account and say, okay, you know, there might be an unintentional bias here and this is how you handle it.
You review a lot of studies. Are there certain questions that you ask yourself to kind of gut check your first reaction?
Yes, all the time. Whenever I see a study that I'm immediately excited about, like anything about how chocolate is good for you, I have to stop and be like, okay, calm down. Let's look at this thing. Are there a lot of people in the study? Is the study strong? What did they control for? Is it funded by a chocolate company? It takes practice to really do that kind of critical thinking every single time you read a study. And I'm human too. I trip up on this sort of thing all the time.
Thank you, Bethany.
Thank you.
Bethany Brookshire, also known as SciCurious, is a writer for Science News and Society for Science and the Public. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. Our theme today is creativity, and we are about to meet a guy who creates mind-blowing illusions for a living. He makes his audiences believe that he can read their minds, and maybe he can. Mentalist and magician Max Major has mastered the art of picking up on body language cues that we all send off all day long, crossing our arms, blinking, tapping our feet. He recently appeared at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia. I caught up with him before his show, and I asked him to give me an example of his skills.
Did you have a pet when you were a kid?
I did have a pet.
Think of the name of that pet. You have it in your head? Mm-hmm. Don't say it out loud. Don't move your lips. Spell it in your mind one time. Good. It's about six letters. I'm trying to watch your eyes as I'm doing this. We all do this when we spell. We kind of nod our head from letter to letter, or our eyes jump. And as you did this, I got around six letters. Is that about right? Focus on the first letter of the name.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a G name? Is it a G? Yeah? Was it something like Golden or Goldie? What was the name of your pet?
Goldie. All right. But you don't know what kind of pet it was, do you?
No, and this isn't some piece of information I could have looked up online about you. It's not a story you've told on air before. No.
No, never. No.
So you asked about reading people. And so what I'm picking up on are very simple cues that people are giving off. So it's things you do with your eyes, with your face, with your body. It's sort of the way that we make decisions, especially when you're focusing on specific letters, you know, where you look. And so I'm sort of taking all of this, all the signals I'm picking up on, and I'm mixing this with a bit of guesswork and sort of deductive reasoning, and sometimes I get very close to knowing exactly what's on someone's mind.
So what was I doing that gave away the G?
I mean, that's something that took me 20 years to learn. So to explain it, you know, in 30 seconds on the radio would probably sort of discount it. You know, at some level, this is something that we all do. You know, if someone were to come through that door right now and they had some very big news to share, right? You would know right away whether it was good news or whether it was bad news. They wouldn't have to say anything or even open their mouth. I mean, we do this naturally. It'd be written on their face. And so what I'm doing is really an extension of that, sort of a deeper understanding of sort of human nature.
We often try in our day-to-day interactions, yes, we try to assess if another person is truthful, if they're mm-hmm. telling us the truth. Is that something you're also good at,
yeah,
based on your skills?
Yeah, I've been called the human lie detector before. That's something I do every night on stages. I challenge a number of people for a large sum of money to tell me lies. And I think we all sort of try to do this. I think it's a skill that's important in conversation to know if someone's being genuine. If you want to sort of read someone that you're talking to, the best thing to do is actually to start at the feet and work your way up. People often think that it's easiest to tell if someone's lying by looking at their face, but the truth is we learn from a very early age how to lie with our faces. As babies, we try to get our way based on, you know, certain faces that we make. And so in actuality, your most reliable detectors of sort of body language start from the ground up. And so if you watch someone's feet, they'll often reveal a lot more about them than their face. The direction someone's feet are pointing may indicate how interested they are in the conversation.
How so? Like, what would my...
Okay. Well, we've all had this experience where you're at an event, you're talking to someone, and they sort of have one foot out the door, so to speak. They're sort of angling their feet away from the conversation, sort of subtly indicating that they're no longer interested or they have somewhere to be. And so we do this subconsciously. This is not something that we think about. The same goes with, you know, crossing the legs or uncrossing the legs. These are signs of sort of closed or open behavior. And so if in a conversation someone were to shift from a very open posture to sort of having their legs closed or their arms crossed, that would indicate in that moment some level of discomfort. And so there's not necessarily one indicator that someone's lying, but what you can sense are changes in emotion. And then from there, you can sort of make judgments about whether that's an indication of lie or simply nervousness or anxiety.
As you were learning this, did you just watch people or videos? How did you go about it?
I read a book called What Everybody Is Saying by a guy named Joe Navarro. You know, the first thing that you'll read in any body language book is just observation. It's just literally to pay attention to the folks that you're talking to and the folks around you. So often when we're in a conversation, we're stuck in our own heads. We're thinking about what we're going to say next rather than paying attention to the person that we're talking to. And so simply by looking for body language, you'll already be a better communicator than most people. And so you go to a coffee shop or you're having lunch by yourself, and it just makes life suddenly so much more interesting. You look at the people around you and try to guess what kind of conversation they're having, how the date is going across the restaurant. It's very fun when you're first learning.
So can you ever not do this when you hang out with your friends, or are you constantly reading their minds?
Well, it's not as if I'm just tapping into a stream of thoughts that are floating through the air. It's a very targeted, direct process. And so I guess at some measure I'm always reading people, but I'm not tuning into their secret thoughts all the time.
Max Major is a magician and a mentalist. His new show is called Think Again. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. From the world of magic to the magical world of ants, not known to be terribly creative creatures, but let's take a closer look. Army ants in the rainforests of South and Central America are master bridge builders. And in perhaps their most innovative move, they use their own bodies. Jessica McDonald explains.
For the predatory army ants of Panama, time matters. The nomadic insects pack up every night to move to a new location.
They live at this really high-paced lifestyle where they need to bring back their food to their nest really quickly, and they're in huge colonies.
That's Princeton ecology graduate student Matthew Lutz. He says hundreds of thousands of ants are out searching for prey and ferrying it back in raiding trails that stretch for up to 200 meters across the forest floor. And that's where the bridges come in. All that travel is expensive.
We know for sure now that they're using these bridges to actually create shortcuts.
The bridges can be as small as a single ant plugging a gap, a bit like a pothole cover. Or, with hundreds of ants clinging to the little hooks on each other's limbs, they can span a foot or more. To find out how the ants make their mini architectural marvels, Lutz and his team studied them in the wild, throwing in new obstacles and videotaping them. While the ants quickly figured out ways to shorten their path and hastily put up new self-construction, they didn't always extend the bridges out and take the most direct route.
We realized that the ants were kind of trading off the benefit of creating a shortcut with the cost of having too many ants locked up in the bridge.
He says the individual ants, by following rules, are performing a kind of cost-benefit analysis on behalf of the entire colony.
The amazing thing is there's no, you know, one ant controlling all this, right? There's no overseeing ant deciding exactly where these bridges move, but they're making these decisions according to very simple local rules.
No master architect drawing up a blueprint. No key designer seeing her vision come to fruition. The rules, honed by millions of years of evolution, boil down to touch and whether a given ant still feels traffic over her back. Lutz, who is an architect by training, says these tiny insects and their by-the-book ways can teach humans a lot about design.
I could easily imagine things like a team of tiny robots who could coordinate their movements according to similar rules and self-assemble into different kinds of structures.
Perhaps not entire bridges, but ant-inspired pothole-filling robots are in the works. For The Pulse, I'm Jessica McDonald.
We have a video of these ants on our website at whyy.org/thepulse. We also recently heard about ants in South Carolina forming life rafts with their own bodies during floods. So it appears that when it comes to survival, most species get pretty creative. Some of the most creative cutting-edge solutions for one of the biggest issues of our time, climate change, were on display during the climate summit in Paris. Reporter Sonia Narang visited a COP21 side exhibition called the Gallery of Solutions, and she talked to the people behind these innovations.
A small electric bus transports people to La Galerie, an exhibition showcasing energy-efficient innovations from around the world. It's set up next to COP21 in a large hall at the old Paris-Les Bourget airport. Rows of colorful booths display all kinds of technologies, everything from ultra-thin photovoltaic road surfaces to drones that measure environmental impact from the sky. My first stop, the booth for a French company, Power Vehicle Innovation, or PVI. They've developed a technology that can recharge an electric bus at quick stops along a route. At each bus shelter, an extendable arm on top of the bus connects to an energy storage system, charging the bus in a mere 10 seconds.
You can drive this without any limitation of range because the bus is charging at every stop automatically.
That's the company's product director, Babak Tafazoli. They've labeled their prototype the Watt system, and their first fleet is operating in southern France. Just a few rows away, I see a small bamboo hut covered in bright African cloth and a tall street lamp. This is the booth for a four-year-old startup called Suna Design.
We are a company who designs and manufactures in France solar streetlights and solution to bring public lighting in Africa.
That's Suna Design's Laura Pergade.
We developed an innovation that is based on a new battery chemistry that is nickel-based and that is very highly resistant to heat.
34-year-old Thomas Samuel is this company's CEO and founder.
The feedback we had from the villagers, it's amazing. It's so good to have light at the center of the village that creates jobs, that creates social activities. But we want to have power inside our house. And we have invented how to distribute a small amount of power to the households.
At this gallery of solutions, a few countries have their own larger exhibition spaces. Saudi Arabia has one of the slickest ones. I strike up a conversation with Amr Zahrani, an environmental engineer from Saudi energy conglomerate Aramco. He shows me around the booth.
Here is the robot that clean the solar panel. You know, in our environment, it's dusty sometimes. So this robot cleans the solar panel frequently.
In the USA pavilion, I meet Alix Armour. She's the founder of a small Southern California startup, Nimble Scooters.
We make these really unique kick scooters that have cargo space made to move things over short distances.
Armour hopes her invention will eliminate the need to drive your giant SUV on a simple errand in your neighborhood. The gallery isn't just hosting small startups. Companies like French infrastructure giant Colas is showing off a new ultra-thin photovoltaic cell. It can be pasted right onto existing roads to create solar energy.
It's very new. I mean, it's something that you can put on the roads everywhere in the world.
That's Julien Ripoche from Colas.
You can produce energy wherever you want. You can use only 20 square meters of this technology to supply your house.
The several hours I spent walking around were really eye-opening. There was so much technology on display that I missed the last electric bus home, forcing me to use the most ancient of energy-saving devices, my own 2 feet. For The Pulse, I'm Sonia Narang. On n'a pas pris la peine de se rassembler un peu avant que le temps prenne nos envies et nos voeux, les images, les querelles, puis passer rancune.
Regardless of the outcome of the Paris Climate Summit, people want to do something that makes a difference right now, creating change in their neck of the woods, perhaps in the maze of canyons that surrounds Los Angeles. Each one of these canyons has a distinct personality. Runyon Canyon has secret hidden parks. Laurel Canyon has its Hollywood stars. Topanga Canyon has hippies and hipsters. And Cheeseboro Canyon has Valley Oaks. Reporter Sandin Totten profiles one man who's trying to save these special trees.
Oaks are the best.
That's Vince Curtis, a real estate appraiser and a regular here at Cheeseboro.
Especially the Valley Oaks. They're just so big and beautiful and majestic.
Valley Oaks are all over the canyon. They're tall, gnarly trees with sprawling branches. The kind of tree that blankets an area with shade. The kind of tree you want to hang a tire swing from or just lie under and read a good book. They're also the kind of tree this canyon could lose due to climate change.
So this is actually an oak. It doesn't look too good.
No, it doesn't. Curtis is tugging on a sapling he planted several years back.
But I can't pull him out. If he gets enough water, he'll start to do really well.
He gives it some water from a bucket. Curtis can't remember exactly when he planted this tree, but that's fair, since he's planted about 700 of them. In the 90s, he would come here on horse to ride the trails with his wife. Then, 15 years ago, he heard that the Valley Oaks were struggling after decades of ranching and invasive plants. Curtis volunteered to fix that.
That's what I've been called, the Johnny Appleseed of oaks, so I'll take it.
He finds an acorn, soaks it, chills it in his fridge to fake winter conditions. Then it's ready for a hole in the ground.
I put an acorn in. I put a little bit of fertilizer, and that's it. But sadly, in the last 5 or 6 years, it just really hasn't rained enough for me to plant them, because if I plant them here, I mean, this is like concrete. I can't be planting them if the soil is just so dry.
Dry soil, hot temperatures, long summers, these are the new threats facing Valley Oaks as the planet warms, says Rosie Daggett. She's a biologist with the Resource Conservation District of the Santa Monica Mountains. The oaks in Cheeseboro are already some of the southernmost valley oaks in California. She says as climate change kicks in, they could be hit hard.
The potential is there for the range of these trees to naturally begin to contract northward.
That would mean the oaks here could die off. Daggett says that would have a huge impact, since oaks in the region
are host to 5,000 species of insects, 58 species of reptiles and amphibians, 150 species of birds, and 105 species of mammals that will disappear if those oak resources disappear.
Scientists say Southern California is likely to see longer periods of drought and hotter days on average because of climate change. Curtis takes me for a ride in his rust-covered truck. Along the way, we pass old oak trees that seem to be falling apart.
That tree, as you saw, fell down. This tree did the same exact thing. This tree did the same exact thing.
Does it make you feel like you're kind of fighting a losing battle here?
Not really. Just because I hope, the drought's just going to be temporary. We'll see.
During the drought, Curtis has been checking on his young trees about once a month, bringing them water and pulling up the dead ones. If a valley oak can dig roots to the water table, it should be able to survive dry times. But when they're young, they need regular soaks. And it's these young ones that are vital for long-term survival of the species.
Let's go up here real quick.
Curtis takes me up a hill that's covered in a dozen or so young but tall and healthy trees. These are some of his first saplings planted 15 years back. Now they're thriving. But for every grove like this, Curtis has planted others that are just barely holding on. That doesn't seem to bother him.
I just don't want to give up thinking, climate change is inevitable, because that's not how things work out.
He tells me about a huge development that was once planned nearby. Most thought it was a done deal, but Curtis and a few others fought it. Now the land is public, part of the National Park Service.
So climate change, development, it's all not inevitable. And yeah, I mean, I do think that maybe my grandkids will come out here and I can say, I planted that oak over there. You know, I think that would be fun too.
He knows this is just one small fight in a much larger battle. And that's daunting. But Curtis loves this valley and its oaks. He says he'd rather do something small than nothing at all. For The Pulse, I'm Sandin Totten.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. Pregnant women get tons of medical advice. So many things could potentially harm the baby growing inside their bellies. Anything from caffeine to seafood to hair dye and yoga. Overwhelmed with so much information, many get a little bit creative with the rules. Tanya English reports.
Every mom does it her own way. In Philadelphia, Michi Hunt says with her first baby, she was almost looking for rules to follow.
I mean, I used to just Google like 22 weeks of pregnancy and I'd read every single website. And then I would click on all those links that say like 10 foods you definitely shouldn't eat.
But Hunt has a big circle of laid back girlfriends, and eventually they helped her relax into her decisions. Now she's pregnant again, 13 weeks with baby number two. With a toddler at home, Hunt says she has less time to obsess over what the internet says. She does listen to her doctor.
I haven't defied anything she's suggested, but I also haven't felt like she's been pushy at all or, you know, very black or white about things.
In Oregon, Alice Callahan is trained as a researcher, and she has a doctorate in nutrition. So it was natural for her to dig into the science to find answers.
So it takes a little while to straighten out what's evidence-based, what's really important, and what are the sort of myths about pregnancy that aren't as important.
Callahan wrote the book, The Science of Mom. She avoided caffeine with her first baby. But during her last pregnancy, Callahan decided to have a bit of coffee every day, and her obstetrician supported that decision.
But it didn't necessarily line up with what everybody else said, you know, and I still would deal with these sort of judgmental looks when I ordered my half-calf latte at the coffee shop with my big belly.
I have a grande decaf, non-fat pumpkin spice latte.
In New Jersey, 30-year-old Colleen Anuko says wine is part of her lifestyle. She has a separate full-time job, but is also training to become a sommelier. At 33 weeks pregnant, with her due date so close, Anuko is in the doctor's office every other week.
I'm always very honest. I say, oh, I had a small glass of red wine last Saturday night. I haven't gotten any sort of feedback from my doctor about that. They just breeze right by it.
But when Anuko had a small glass at a restaurant recently, she got stares from strangers.
I mean, it was like a spit of wine, and I just wanted to taste the wine. So I'm like tasting it, and I realized that, like, I guess maybe I should have worn baggier clothing or whatever so it wasn't so prominent that here's this pregnant lady tasting wine. But you get the eyes.
At Pennsylvania Hospital, the labor and delivery team gathered in the break room to talk about giving advice to their patients.
So, you guys, let's just go around the room so that Tanya can get everybody here.
Nancy Hazel, I'm one of the nurses.
There were two nurse midwives, a couple of senior physicians, a labor and delivery nurse, and a resident. Obstetrician gynecologist Sabrina Sukan says there's some wiggle room in her recommendations, but she has lots of education to do and a very short time to do it. So unless she's talking to a close friend, she sticks to the script from the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists.
If I'm not on the clock, absolutely, I might have a full discussion about what the scientific research actually shows as opposed to what the party line is.
There's nuance to almost all the do's and don'ts. Soft cheese is actually okay. It's unpasteurized dairy that's the problem.
Sushi and sex, both fine.
Nurse midwife Christy Warinsky tells patients to only go to restaurants they trust. Sushi in the United States is usually flash frozen, so parasites aren't a big worry. But even garden variety food poisoning can be more severe if you're pregnant.
If you're not sure, have a conversation with your doctor.
OB Peter Gerhardt says it's also fine to keep your appointment at the beauty salon.
So you have to look good to feel good. Hair dyes okay, as is nail polish.
He says coloring is applied to the hair, which is mostly dead cells, and very little gets absorbed into the skin. Sitting next to Gerhardt is nurse midwife Nancy Hazel. She says expecting women usually are quick to take her suggestions.
What is the big one that women push back on? Is there one that comes up all the time that you have to have a longer conversation about?
Smoking.
Wow, I would not think that would be a debate at all.
People can't stop. They want to stop. They can't stop. They have a hard time stopping.
Hazel tells moms not to drink, but she makes an exception for big celebrations like New Year's Eve. For Peter Gerhardt, there are no exceptions. Drinking alcohol during pregnancy can cause birth defects. And because a fetus grows rapidly, Gerhardt says the brain is vulnerable. The newest public health message on alcohol in pregnancy is not one drop.
If you need to celebrate, you can have a ceremonial toast, touch it to your lips, but it's best not to drink.
The doctors and nurses around the room said they give guidance, but moms ultimately decide what's best. Mother of two, Alice Callahan, who wrote the book The Science of Mom, says most pregnancy recommendations come from big teams of public health experts.
They do have to make sort of simple recommendations for an entire population.
But when an individual mom does a risk-benefit analysis, her health and her situation are the factors that tend to matter the most. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
Our next story is about a doctor who found himself in an impossible situation with a seemingly impossible patient. This was early on in his career, and he decided to improvise. Travis Baggett is an internist at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, and he told this story as part of the American College of Physicians Doctor Story Slam.
He shuffled slowly into the pink-walled room, sat down across from me in an orange plastic school chair. His face was flat. My palms were sweaty. We were two men sitting quietly face to face in a women's bathroom. But it wasn't just any women's bathroom. This is a women's bathroom in a homeless shelter for people with serious mental illness. I was early in my tenure as a primary care doc at the shelter. The idea was to reach out to people, meet them on their own terms. In hindsight, the women's bathroom may have missed the mark on that a little bit, but it was the one place in the shelter with a sink and the space to run our clinic. When I first started doing this work about 5 years ago, I had very little clue what I was doing. But the day that Dennis shuffled into that room and sat down across from me in that orange chair, something changed. He was a 50-year-old man who had just moved into the shelter after spending many years living alone on the streets. He took no meds, wasn't really keen on seeing doctors. I learned that about a month before I met him, he'd actually broken his arm. But he never followed through on getting it fixed. And so when he landed in the shelter, the staff there did what anyone would do for a man with a broken arm. They sent him to the women's bathroom to see an internal medicine doctor. When I met Dennis, I asked him about his arm. He just looked at it, almost like it wasn't his. And he said, "Doesn't feel broken." He spoke in short, cryptic sentences with words that were sometimes made up. His eyes were empty, his hair was unkempt. He was wearing a video game joystick around his neck like a necklace. He had taken dozens of those rubber wristbands, you know, the kind made famous by Lance Armstrong, shoved them tightly up around his upper arm. He was clearly ill in many ways, but he didn't want a thing from me. He was there only because of the shelter staff. Asked him to come see me. Now, I had no idea what to do next. I mean, I knew as a primary care doctor there were any number of things I could talk to him about in the name of good care, things like vaccines or screening tests, but somehow in that moment, none of that really seemed to matter. As we sat there quietly, his feet caught my eyes. On his left foot, he was wearing an aqua sock covered by a blue Velcro post-op shoe. On his right foot, he was wearing no shoe at all, just a wool stocking cap that he had pulled tightly over his foot and fixed to his ankle with another one of those rubber wristbands, but this one didn't say Live Strong on it. No, this one right there on the dirty ankle of this broken outcast said, in all caps, Amazing Grace. I wasn't sure how this next part would go, but I gave it a try. "Dennis, could I wash your feet?" He said yes. He said yes. After a long soak, I toweled his feet off, gave him a clean pair of socks. Shelter staff helped him find a proper pair of shoes, and we sent him on his way. I didn't write a single script. I didn't give him any doctorly advice at all. But about a week later, he went and had his arm tended to by the orthopedist. About a week after that, he saw a psychiatrist and agreed to start meds to help his thinking. I saw him in passing about 3 months later, and I barely recognized him. He waved at me with a big smile and said, "Hey, doc." Shortly after that, he moved into a group home, and I never saw him again. But in that brief slice of time that I knew Dennis, he taught me that sometimes when people are really broken, the thing they need most isn't a vaccine or a diagnosis or a medication or counseling. Sometimes they just need someone to treat them kindly. Thank you.
Travis Baggett is an internist at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. He told this story as part of the American College of Physicians Doctor Story Slam. It's just a restless feeling by my side. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Tani Nariush is our intern, and this is her last week with us, so we want to thank her for all of her great work, and we do wish her the best of luck. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager is our associate producer, Joel Patterson, our managing editor, and Megan Pinto, the executive producer. Did you miss some of the show or any of our previous shows? shows, just subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes or at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. They are proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches. IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.